This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Stop me if you've heard this one before. Politicians and pundits start accusing teachers of being socialists and indoctrinating students into their nefarious way of thinking and demand an investigation. This actually happened in New York just before the start of the Second World War and is now seen as the seed that gave birth to McCarthyism after the war.
It's about a perceived threat of communism and of socialism more generally to American democracy in the schools and elsewhere.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll look back at that investigation and how it ripped through the New York school system. We'll also spend an academic minute learning how your poker game tells us about the type of person you are away from the table. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. This story begins in late summer 1940. At the time, war was spreading across Europe, and the United States was finally pulling itself out of the Great Depression. While all this was going on, an anti-communist hysteria began taking root in New York City. It was aimed at the city's educators and would go on for the better part of 2 years. Targeting the city's municipal colleges and public schools, the New York State Legislature's Rapp-Kudert investigation dragged hundreds of suspects before public and private tribunals to root out an imagined communist conspiracy to hijack the city's teachers' unions, subvert public education, and indoctrinate the nation's youth. Now, history professor Andrew Pfeffer has written the first full history of this witch hunt, which lasted from August 1940 to March 1942. The book is called Bad Faith: Teachers, Liberalism, and the Origins of McCarthyism. Dr. Andrew Pfeffer is professor of history and co-director of the Interdisciplinary Program in Film Studies at Union College in Schenectady, New York. He spoke about the book with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue, who asked why he found it important to study this period in New York education history.
Well, McCarthyism is always an important issue in American history, and it's become more important in some ways in recent American politics. But I actually got started on this project through another project that brought me down to the New York State Archives, and I came across the Rapp-Kudert archive there, and it's an enormous collection of very, very important documents, and it just sucked me in.
What was it about those archives that you found interesting?
Well, first of all, they're one of the most complete archives on an investigation of teachers, of communist teachers, and the influence of communism in American schools. And it's a very, very important event in the history of McCarthyism. Some consider it a prelude to McCarthyism. It sets McCarthyism on a particular course, and for that reason was very, very important.
The title of the book is Bad Faith. Why is that an apt title? What does that describe?
Well, communists were accused of lying, of misrepresentation, that they lied about the fact that they were communists, but that they also lied about what the intentions of the Communist Party were. Teachers in the New York City school system, which this book is about the investigation of those teachers, were accused of misrepresenting themselves as unbiased teachers when, in fact, as members of the Communist Party, it was claimed they were indoctrinating students, trying to foment class war with the hopes of overthrowing the American government by force and violence. That was the bad faith that they were accused of. But in fact, they were not indoctrinating students. They were extremely good teachers. They had very good records. And they played an important role in reforming American education, especially making the New York City public schools and the municipal colleges more democratic, more open, more diverse.
This obviously was targeted towards the schools in the city and the state, but had ripple effects, of course.
Yeah, the Rapp-Kudert investigation built a body of documents and evidence that was later used during the McCarthyism period proper. The thing to know about this investigation was it occurred before the Second World War, and therefore before the Cold War. So it's not about the threat of the Soviet Union to the United States, the national security threat. It's about a perceived threat of communism and of socialism more generally to American democracy in the schools and elsewhere. It indicates the extent to which anti-communism had much deeper roots in American political culture than just the conflicts of the Cold War, which occurs after the Second World War.
August 1940 to March 1942. So bring us to August 1940 and what happens?
Well, what happens is the New York State Legislature passes enabling legislation to set up a committee, a joint committee of the Assembly and the Senate, to investigate problems in the state school systems that included financial problems, but also questions of administration. And that was interpreted to allow a committee or a subcommittee to be set up to investigate the influence of very subversive organizations in the New York City schools. At the time, the New York City schools were perceived to be a problem, in large part, and especially the municipal colleges, in large part because the Communist Party and other left-wing parties had gained some influence there. And notably, in the teachers' unions that represented both teachers and staffs in the public school system and in the municipal colleges. That investigation was enabled by that legislation. It was set up by the state legislature. It was a state legislative investigation. It had certain powers. And it had the power basically to bring people before its tribunals in public hearings and also in private meetings to interrogate them about their political affiliations, about who their friends were, about what they taught in their classes, about what they believed, and then to expose them to the public as threats to American public education, to American democracy. It was unmistakably a witch hunt. It resulted in the firing of dozens of municipal college employees, including staff as well as teachers, and it opened the door for McCarthyism after the Second World War.
What was the reason given for those who were fired? What was the reason given? What
ultimately
did they do to deserve that?
Well, they didn't do anything to deserve it. They were
in their mind, right?
In the mind of the people who were accusing them, that they lied about being in the Communist Party, and that's the main thing. I mean, ultimately, that's the justification that was publicly given. People were brought before the committee. They were sworn under oath. They were asked if they were members of the Communist Party. This is where McCarthyism begins. Are you now, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And teachers, for the most part, if they admitted that they were communists, would be summarily fired. There was nothing to be gained for them personally, individually, by admitting that they were in the Communist Party. So they're backed up against the wall. Also, if they admitted they were in the Communist Party and say, okay, I'm a communist, I do good things in the school, I'm a good teacher, I've promoted racial justice and equality in the schools, they would be then be for the primary interest of the committee would be to force them to expose other communists. So they would have to expose their friends under the threat of legislative contempt, contempt of Congress in the federal setting, but the state legislature has the same power. And so they didn't want to admit they were communists because then it gets them caught in the trap of having to name names. So it made complete sense for them not to say that they were communists. By not saying they were communists, they weren't hiding anything else. They weren't trying to overthrow the government. They weren't indoctrinating their students. There is no evidence amassed by the Rapp-Kudert Committee, the legislative committee in question here. There is no evidence amassed by them that teachers in the New York public school system or in the municipal colleges indoctrinated students. It was an empty accusation. That was the essence of the bad faith that the committee claimed communists practiced. But the evidence of it was that they lied, and then they were fired for lying.
One of the things that surprised me in all of this is this does, talk about trickle down, so this does impact the students.
Oh, absolutely. Students were denied. First of all, these were great teachers. The students, by the students' testimony, they were unbiased, they were fair, they were excellent at presenting their material, they were excellent teachers. So they lost the teachers, first of all. But they also lost a perspective in American higher education in the municipal colleges and also in public education in general, a perspective the communists provided on questions of economic justice, racial equality, gender equality, a whole range of areas, and a dissenting perspective that encouraged students to look at the world differently than was being proposed to them by more conservative teachers or the more conservative administrators of the public schools and of the colleges.
Who was overseeing all of this, and ultimately who was pulling the strings?
That's a very good question. It's to some extent unanswered. Or it's not easily answered, I should say that. The legislation was supported by both Democrats and Republicans. Upstate Republicans were very conservative. And downstate Democrats, for the most part, who were part of the Tammany Hall machine at that point in American history. And so it represents sort of a bipartisan attack on the Communist Party and on the left in general. But interestingly, the other people who were involved here, and they were involved from very early in the 1930s, were liberals, liberal educators, including some liberal politicians, who perceived the Communist Party, communism in general, to be a threat to what might be called a more liberal agenda for reform by negotiating, by more moderate forms of reform. And the Communist Party, they believed, through the Communist Party's tactics, which usually involved mass mobilizations and mass actions, more confrontational politics, that Communist Party way of doing politics was a threat to the liberal tradition. And so we're talking about people like Paul Windels. Paul Windels is an unappreciated person in New York City history. Very few people know about him, but he was basically the architect of Fiorello LaGuardia. LaGuardia was the mayor from 1934 to the middle of the 1940s, a reform mayor in the history of New York City. And Windels was a liberal. He served as the chief investigator and the chief counsel for the Rapp-Kudert investigation. People like John Dewey, surprisingly, very, very liberal, an advocate of greater tolerance, of child-centered education, of liberal reforms, of many of the reforms of the New Deal. But Dewey emphatically perceived communism to be a threat to American liberalism. And so we have liberals as well as conservatives, Democrats as well as Republicans. They gang up on communists. And anti-communism in this way becomes basically the mainstream of American politics.
The subtitle of the book, Teachers, Liberalism, and the Origins of McCarthyism, is there a direct link between what happened and what we saw with McCarthyism in the sense of taking a page out of the playbook?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I mean, you have many of the documents that are collected, including interrogations and interrogation records and then other kinds of documents by the Rapp-Kudert Committee, are then used later by the McCarran Committee in the Senate, by the House Un-American Activities Committee, in later investigations of communists and later persecutions of communists and non-communists in the period of McCarthyism proper, which begins roughly 1947. But also, the method of the Kudert investigation basically sets the standard for McCarthyist interrogations and for the McCarthyite approach to entrapping people and purging them from American life.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with Andrew Pfeffer continues with a look at the end of the investigation. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Professor Andrew Pfeffer, a professor of history at Union College in Schenectady, New York. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about his new book called Bad Faith, Teachers, Liberalism, and the Origins of McCarthyism.
As I mentioned, March 1942 is the date you give for this, the end of this, if you will. What happened, and did that have great finality to it?
No, I mean, in one sense it did. The investigation officially was ended, and it submitted its report to the state legislature. And people can read that report. It's on the stacks at the New York State Library. The reason why it ended at that point was very simply that the war began, and the war preoccupied people. But also, at that moment as well, as we entered into an alliance with the Soviet Union, public opinion about the Soviet Union and, to some extent, communism, but public opinion about the Soviet Union changed, became more favorable. But during the war, Frederick Kudert Jr., who was the Kudert of the Rapp-Kudert Committee, who was the primary person who was running the committee's or representing the committee's activity in the legislature, Kuder continued to pursue communists more privately through his office. And then many of the people who were investigated and who did not do what the committee wanted them to do, didn't cooperate with the committee effectively, or may have misrepresented or lied about their membership in the Communist Party, those people were pursued after the war, and some of them were fired as late as 1948.
The most surprising thing about the story is that you think of New York City. I mean, you touched on this a moment ago, but New York City is this bastion of liberalism. Certainly, the Academy is as a bastion of liberalism. So where it would seem that this could take place in a what we now refer to as red states, that it's very odd to have it in New York City.
Well, yes, New York City is a bastion of liberalism now. In the 1930s, that wasn't quite the case. There still was the legacy of Tammany Hall, which is hardly liberal. New York State, the upstate Republicans in New York State were adamantly anti-tax, very, very conservative, and sometimes extremist. And at the same time, there was a great deal of extremist right-wing activity in New York at the time. The German-American Bund was very, very active in New York City, as well as the rest of New York State. These are Nazi sympathizers. The Christian Front, an offshoot of the work of Father Charles Coughlin, the radio priest, was also very, very active in New York City. There were sometimes nightly rallies of the Christian Front, which were anti-Semitic, anti-communist, very, very radically right-wing. So there's that element in New York at the time. But the important thing to understand, too, is that liberals, some of them actually members of the Socialist Party, conservative socialists, we would call them, or social democrats, went after communists within the trade union movement, in the teachers' union initially, beginning in 1932-1933. This is fairly deep roots in the history of the period. Liberals went after communists as well as conservatives. Liberals have perceived communists to be threats. They did throughout much of the McCarthyist period, and they were willing to tolerate McCarthy's excesses because they thought the communists were a real threat to American democracy. One of the points of this book is that that eradicated a tradition in the United States. It made it very, very difficult for the left to be functional in American politics. It made communism a bad word. It made socialism a bad word. And that was, had a very, I think, a very devastating, very deleterious effect on American politics, American education. And it was, to some extent, liberals who were responsible for this. Not solely, but to some extent, they were responsible.
So let me end with this question, which is, what was the damage that was done, and how was academic freedom, open debate, brought back into the classroom?
Well, between roughly the end of the Second World War and the end of the 1960s, it was basically impossible to be a communist and be a teacher in the United States. It was also very, very difficult to express a left-wing position or to even have left-wing affiliations outside, in your personal life, outside of the classroom. It's not until 1967 that the Supreme Court comes down emphatically on the side of academic freedom, considering it something that was constitutionally protected. That's a decision called Cajun versus the State of New York or the University of Buffalo. And it was a watershed decision that opens up the possibility of academic freedom in the United States. However, the habit of hiding one's political affiliations and being concerned about one's political associations continued into the 1970s. And so academic freedom was profoundly compromised by McCarthyism in general and initially by investigations like the Rappaport investigation.
Dr. Andrew Pfeffer is professor of history and co-director of the Interdisciplinary Program in Film Studies at Union College in Schenectady, New York. His book is called Bad Faith: Teachers, Liberalism, and the Origins of McCarthyism. He spoke about the book with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. The way you act as a poker player says a lot about the way you act as a human walking the streets. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
What can poker experts tell us? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Seth Frey, assistant professor of communication at the University of California, Davis, looks into how winning poker players use two sources of information where most only see one.
Games are important for telling us how people think and how we think about each other. Then my friends and I wanted to know what distinguishes expert poker players from amateurs. Winning in a game like poker means making profitable decisions while staying unpredictable. But if you think about it, those goals are opposed. Making profitable decisions means leveraging your opponent's behavior, while staying unpredictable often means randomizing on their behavior. Should you leverage it or ignore it? Can you have it both ways? To answer these questions, we looked at a few million hands of online poker by tens of thousands of players, with special attention to how players mix private information, the strength of their cards, with public information, the strength of their opponent's action. We showed that unprofitable players, the losers, were more likely to ignore their cards and focus myopically on their opponents, while experts were more likely to act not on their opponent's loan or even on their cards alone, but on how those two interact. Basically, the experts were better at combining different sources of information to gain new, more holistic insights that couldn't have come from one place alone. Okay, so poker experts are better at thinking about poker. What's so interesting about that? Well, if you remember our question, there was this trade-off between being profitable and being unpredictable. But if you never react to the player without scrambling your reaction up with your cards, you make your motivations impossible to reverse engineer. With holistic reasoning, experts literally encrypt their thinking with their cards while revealing nothing about themselves. Where so much of the research about decision-making treats people as victims of uncertainty beyond their control, what we have here are experts actively courting uncertainty and bending it very creatively to get ahead, with the same technology that keeps your computer secure. Whoever expected that from studying games?
That was Seth Frey of the University of California, Davis. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.